Good morning, we're the Historians. I'm Jay Sammons here with my longtime friend and Boston University colleague, Professor Brendan McConville.
Coming to you from the shadow of Bellevue Hill and the mystical electronic banks of the Charles.
Oh, the electronic banks of the Charles and Bellevue Hill. Are you ensconced in your historian's proper office with books piled behind you left and right?
Indeed, I am. As you know, I've been complaining bitterly about the smallness of my palatial office here in West Roxbury.
I know. I mean, you have the palatial estate, so obviously, you know, the office should be enlarged. I noticed something in your office I haven't ever seen before, a New York Giants football helmet.
That is actually a real New York Giants from their team supply. My brother-in-law, who was staying with us, I think we mentioned that before, that he had that had serious cancer, and he was staying with us being treated at Dana-Farber, which I definitely recommend to our listeners. And he is a very successful high school football coach in the Catholic League in Chicago. And several of his players are in the NFL, guys who worked with him as coach. And one of them at that time was on the Giants, you know, was on the Giants, and I'm a Giants fan. So he was able to get me a real Giants helmet,
which
I now have here in my office.
That's very cool.
Very cool. Very nice of this player, who I can't remember his name, but his player helped him out.
How are the Giants doing this year?
It's not looking good. Saquon Barkley, who's really a spectacular running back and seems like a really nice young guy, took an ACL injury and is out for at least a year. It's a complete tear, apparently. And, you know, he's a star running back, and he's one of these guys who really did it right as a player and a person, and you just hate to see that, you know?
Just one more way in which 2020 is the year that keeps on taking.
The year that keeps on abusing us. I know.
Takes and takes and takes. Well, what are you having for breakfast this morning? Let's try to salve our sadness with some breakfast.
I am having a bagel. It is going to be a toasted garlic bagel with cream cheese, not butter, cream cheese.
Okay.
And I'm having 4 strips of bacon and some orange juice.
Good. The bacon makes me that makes it. That makes it. That makes breakfast. All right. Well, since you're having bacon, I will have sausage and bacon with my 2 eggs over easy. And
listeners, it's a double swine morning at the
Salmon
House.
Exactly. And I'm also going to have rye toast and hash browns. I'm gonna let myself go crazy with the carbs. I usually don't do that, you know.
Double swine, double carbs over at the Salmon House.
Well, you know, if my father succeeds in acquiring this property in Arkansas that he's looking at, we may be raising pigs at Arkansas, or at least goats.
Incidentally, not to go off on this, but apparently there's this enormous number of feral hogs that have gone, you know, they've become wild pigs now, and they're spreading all over the country. They call it the swine bomb, and it's like spreading all over. And apparently these things are really dangerous.
Yep, they're all over the place. They're all over the South, Texas, they're in Pennsylvania, they're all over, because people don't hunt them anymore.
Yeah, why can't we just wipe them out?
Well, I don't want to wipe them out. I want to harvest them.
Harvest, right.
So I'm going to put in for some harvesting of wild hogs.
Listeners, salmons, swine, and swine and potato. That'll be the name of that company.
Pork at every meal. That was my grandfather's motto. So. And it worked.
Right.
Well, speaking of pork, one of the more popular meats in the world, not as popular as goat, which is the most eaten meat in the world. Goat is, absolutely.
Is that because of in Hindu country in India, they use goat and goat and chicken? And
that's
part of it?
Probably part of it. And part of it, too, is just it's a lot easier to raise than other things. Americans don't have a real taste for goat. Personally, I like it. But you don't find a lot of it in your market.
I have never eaten goat. I have a kind of high opinion of goats because they're like me, a non-discerning, regardless of, you know, they behave a certain way regardless of conditions.
But, they also like to climb mountains. That's why I think you and goats have in common.
Yes, they do.
Mountain climbings. And butt heads with other hard-headed things.
Right.
All right, we can go on this subject. But today I know we're going to go back to a theme of the show, which is World History Update. And I have to admit, I'm really glad we're going to be looking at the world today because I'm not enjoying looking at the United States too much. It is just depressing. And sometimes, you know, you need to look and see what's going on in the rest of the world. So,
yeah, I we have a lot of problems. And, yep. you know, let's I mean, everyone who's listening knows that it's, you can't avoid it. Yep. To the first topic isn't as necessarily as happy and uplifting.
Uh-oh.
As it is. Because one of the things I've talked about a lot on the show, especially in regard to Japan, but also in regard to other places, is the demographic structure of the global human population. And that's something that's fascinated me for 15 years, at least, if not longer, maybe 20 years. Because I can remember talking about it to my class when I first came to BU the first year I was here. And people mm-hmm. looked at me like I was insane when I said, look, right. global population is going to peak and start coming down. And it's already peaked or is beginning to peak in a number of places, particularly at that time, Japan, Italy, South Korea. And the students looked at me like I was insane. Why did they look at me like I was insane? Because we're raised with this Malthusian myth, which is that human population is always going to grow. Yep. And that's always going to be the problem unless we, you know, restrain it and stop it somehow. And that the biggest problem we can have, that humans are environmentally destructive, and that that's the biggest problem that we have. And of course, look, that's a major problem. It's that understanding has also been folded into the whole crisis over global warming, and the way people talk about that is that it's produced by humans. The more humans you have, the same thing with extinction events and extinction of animals. And of course, there's a lot of truth to that. If you have, you know, 8 billion apex predators on the planet, quite a few apex predators. But I want to talk about it today in the first segment, because I see this as becoming more and more determinant on us. And I actually even see some of the problems we're having in the United States today, although they're not discussed in this term or related to this. So, and as our problems in the rest of the world, you know, and conflicts in the rest of the world are in some part related to the notion that our population, there is a growing and visible change in the nature of the population trajectory. And that in many places in the world, human population is near its, apparently, if things continue as they have been, it's going to be near peak or it is already peaked. And of course, and that's why I always go back to Japan, because Japan is one of the places where it's peaked. South mm-hmm. Korea is a place where it's peaked. Italy is a place where it's peaked. There's a number of other places, you know, regions or in whole countries where population has peaked and is starting to go down.
You know, Brendan, I'm teaching Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire this semester. And when I get to the 3rd century AD and we start talking about the problems Rome was facing at that point, I have about 12 things that I go over with my class. And one of them is depopulation. And this is really the first time I've taught this class where I've been able to put it in contemporary context, basically from conversations, you know, that we've had on the air and off the air from your concern in this area, that depopulation is a real factor in our lives now.
In our lives. This is a piece from the BBC News from July 15th. Because of the way we've been doing our interviews and stuff, and we haven't been doing the news, it kept me off, which is one of the reasons I want to do this. This is the title of the piece, which is now caught up with, you know, we've been leading on this for as long as, but listen to this. This is the title. Fertility rate, jaw-dropping global crash in children being born. That's from the BBC, July 15th. 23 countries will see their populations halved, cut in half by 2100. In other words, by the end of the century.
Wow.
That is not only a human thing, but it also impacts the environment, how land use, other animal species. And you can see some of those countries, Japan, Spain, South Korea, Italy, Portugal. Why is this happening? And of course, the answer is always, there's a stock series of answers. Well, there's urbanization, people moving to the towns, and there's women and they're having careers and being out of the home, later marriage, and birth control. That's how people generally explain this. Hmm. Yeah. And of course,
those are all ways to explain the fact that we are not having as many babies.
Right. But it's not explaining why we're not having as many babies.
Yeah.
So there's a deeper thing. I started to read into this and I read several pieces that go back to the end of World War II, the period between 1945 and say 1955, when we are always taught baby boom, right? But it's interesting, some of these studies, which biodemographers, some of them were commissioned by the United States government, they said the two wars, meaning the First and Second World War, have removed from Europe and East Asia, there's a kind of social lethargy and the way people are perceiving their lives, which is leading, you know, in this direction towards a depopulation. They saw this 70 years ago, 80 years ago. that it was going to happen. And of course, family sizes have been getting smaller across the span of, you know, the 19th and the 20th century in many Western countries, although not all, but most. And the question starts to arise. So some of these studies and some of these contemporary writers, and there's a whole bunch of them, there's a whole bunch of them, they start to say, well, maybe it's because of the change in spiritual values that tend to come with urbanization, which clearly that's part of it. And it's not just a Christianity thing. It's also a thing. It's a thing in China. It's a thing in Japan. It's a thing in Korea. It's a thing in parts of Africa. And as urbanization tends to lead to a de-churching of people, in other words, their spiritual life seems to change. But these studies and some of them touched on this, but some of them also said there's a kind of general lack of engagement and commitment to continuation of families and whole cultures. And I have to say, there's something to that. It's clear there's something to that. I mean, they know this in Japan and even in China, which had the one child policy and which sort of began this process by force. Now they regret it and are trying to reverse it, and they can't. And so it's creating a crisis. Part of this crisis will be this: the current entire global economic system is based on the premise of there will always be increasing demand.
That's right.
That means more people. If you have fewer people, there's less demand, which means that the entire set of socioeconomic assumptions, including, as we've talked about on the show and in private, the welfare state and all these things, they are not sustainable in the same way. And in fact, I think that it's not just, we'll have to, whatever. It will demand an entire reorganization of society in a manner that all the talk about, the way we're talking about politics now in America and in Western societies will be meaningless to describe the necessary changes and the necessary, if they can be made, peacefully at all. And I think that many of the changes we're going to see, which we're going to, as we go to our South Asian update and East Asian update today, and then next week or soon when we do our EU stuff on the EU, we're going to talk about how this demographic thing runs through some of these conflicts or helps define some aspects of these conflicts. You can't be reducing everything to that. It doesn't work.
Yeah, but, and there are going to be different causes in different places, but I understood. But I do think that this spiritual / social part of it is a major a cause in a lot of areas. And the way that men and women relate to each other, Brendan, has changed so radically since the Second World War. I just don't think that can be taken off the table.
It absolutely can't.
If you want to think of the relationship between men and women as a kind of contract that existed until the late 20th century, the terms of that contractual relationship have completely and utterly changed, such that both sides, I think, ask themselves, why would I go into this contract now?
Right. And where that's most pronounced, again, you see that most said in public in Japan. Yeah. And as I've talked to you before, 1/4 of the young men in Japan have no interest in having, physical relationships with women.
Yeah, and the interesting part of that is that what a traditional society Japan has been.
Right.
That you see this most starkly in the most traditional society. I think that adds some weight to this evaluation, that this change in the social structure happening in a very traditional society is going to show itself in that kind of society.
Absolutely. Here's a headline from The Economist on page 37 of the July 25th edition. The title, it's about demography in England and Wales. The title of the piece, Turning Japanese. Also, I would also call people...
Because they're not having children either.
Not having children either.
Right.
And this is another interesting piece, and it's by Janan Ganesh, the guy who I disagree with that almost everything, but writes, who I also like, who writes in the Financial Times. He says, will this be the century of the immigrant? And one of the things he says is that our contemporary debates about immigration are not being fully informed, although sometimes people bring it up, by this underlying demographic issue within native populations in various countries. And that creates, like in Japan, it's very hard for a traditional culture like Japan. They've always been sort of not interested in immigration. So it creates a whole bunch of different dynamics. We are coming up on our first break. We're going to be right back. We're the historians.
When you're working, the hours can be really early, causing drowsiness that inhibits productivity. That's why I like to start every morning with a cup of Joe by New England Coffee. New England Coffee is made from only the finest coffee beans from Africa, Central, and South America. New England Coffee offers tons of different options covering all over the light to dark roast spectrum, so you can find that perfect sweet spot for your coffee cravings. Next time you need a wake me up, choose New England Coffee. Available at supermarkets, restaurants, and institutional dining areas near you.
All right, we're back. We're the historians. We're doing a world history update. We just found out once again that people are not having babies. There's an absolute epidemic of non-baby having all over the world.
Interestingly, one of the other things I did want to talk about, but then we're going to talk a little bit about South Asia, is the only place where you see the poorest countries have the highest birth rates.
Yep.
They are in Africa, in parts of South Asia. Those areas have high birth rates. The areas to the north of them have low birth or, you know, negative birth rate. In other words, they're losing population. And of course, that's creating tensions and shear and different issues. And many of the issues that we see in the sort of northern part of sub-Saharan Africa, which we attribute to, you know, a clash between Islamic peoples and other peoples, are tied to this demographic stuff as well. And of course, that takes a more complex knowledge of that than I have. But you can see that's part of the way it's being played out. Mm. I want now to turn to our South Asian update, which is something that we go to frequently, but I want to talk about a couple of different issues first before I return to the Sino-Indian border dispute, which is continuing to rage and becoming more dangerous almost by the week. I want to turn to the Sri Lankan election, which, of course, we haven't covered Sri Lanka, and there's a reason for this, you know, in the sense that it's not an area that gets a ton of coverage in news unless you start reading the Times of India and then you start reading, you know, Hindustani Times and the other English language papers in India. And you start reading, you know, that other the South China Morning Post. Then there's more coverage. The Sri Lanka, to give a kind of background, of course, it's an island off the coast of what we would see as the south eastern coast of India, sort of to the south and east of India. It's a very substantial area. It has an ancient culture or cultures that have existed there for thousands of years. In terms of the early modern period, which I know more about, it was colonized first by the
Dutch, Portuguese,
before the Portuguese, then the
Dutch,
then the
British.
Got it. It's amazing how many places are like that. But yes, it was colonized by the Portuguese beginning in 1517. The Dutch captured it in 1656 during, I think, at the same time, or approximately the same time as the first Anglo-Dutch War, around that same period. And then the English took it during the Napoleonic Wars because they thought that the French might use it to threaten British control in India, which had really become almost complete at that point, the British East Indies Company. Yeah. Wow. So it was used in that period as a commodity growing area, ultimately became known as most famous as a tea growing area. In contemporary society, I think most of our listeners would know Sri Lanka from the terrible civil war there that ran from the 1980s into the first decade of this century. It pitted the Sinhalese majority, who are a Buddhist people primarily, against the people in the northern portion of Sri Lanka, who are called the Tamils, who are a Hindu people. It was a war which atrocities were committed on both sides. It was a bloody civil war. The Tamils are a smaller portion. They're only about 10 to 12% of the population, and the Sinhalese are about 70%. They're the majority on the island. That fighting, the Tamils are a people. There are also quite a few Tamil people in southern India.
Yeah.
And of course, that, you know, one of the, incidentally, for our listeners, our vice presidential candidate on the Democratic ticket is her mother is a Tamil. She's from, I believe, from southern India, but it's a Tamil family, and Tamil was a Tamil, excuse my pronunciation, speaking family. Mm-hmm. Tamil, I believe that's the correct pronunciation.
I think that's right, Tamil.
Tamil. And it was a horrible civil war. Of course, the Tamils were defeated, the Tamil Tigers, who some of our listeners will remember. Now, why I bring this up now and want to sort of bring it in now is that there have been a series of issues there, you know, including that terrible terrorist attack by the Muslim group on those Christians, who were a remnant population. I believe those people were remnant Catholic population created by the Portuguese colonization. There was an attack on them recently by an extremist Muslim group. Led to a massacre. But the election there, the person elected there to the leadership of the country was their name. It's a family. It's their name is Raj Apakasa. They've had their control basically for a number of decades of Sri Lankan politics. Why I bring this up is this. That family is seen as being pro-Chinese, okay, as opposed to the Indians are in conflict with them. This is now leading to a major naval buildup between the Chinese and the Indians and those who the Indians are now trying to seek or bring into a kind of loose alliance with them against the Chinese over control of the passages through, you know, the southern Indian, around the Indian Ocean, struggling for control. The Sri Lankans accepted Belt and Road money. Okay. For their port development, and the Chinese, because they couldn't fully pay it, the Chinese have basically taken a 99-year lease, I think it is, on one of those southern ports in Sri Lanka. And this isn't, incidentally, to talk about it in terms of the Chinese and Indian strategic conflict, it's not to diminish what's going on in Sri Lanka itself, because there's a whole different set of dynamics at work. And, of course, it's, as I said, very hard to learn because of our... you know, the fixation of Western press on like the Kardashians and stuff, far more important than the 3 billion people living in South Asia. Well, it's true.
It is true.
It is true. So what's happened is that family, they've returned to power. They're seen as being shown pro-Chinese. That port in southern Sri Lanka has been now become a port, you know, in other words, a Chinese-dominated port with visitation rights and everything. And, of course, what's happening now is that this has led to a conflict, a buildup in the Indian Ocean between the two powers. The Indians now feel like, hey, the Chinese are trying to, you know, push in here, and they're on our turf. And this has led them to deploy. I mean, India has one aircraft carrier and is now building another one on their own sort of domestic model. They also have a one, I believe that was purchased from the French, that aircraft carrier, but it carries modern planes. And they're talking already about, you know, the Chinese are coming in here and they're going, you know, they're going to try to push through. Why the Chinese want presence in the Indian Ocean? Because of their investment in Ethiopia and their dependence on the oil fields in Iran primarily is their oil provider. They know they need to be able to keep those routes open. It's also a major trade route to Europe. Right. They know they need to keep those. And they're afraid that India, who they now see as an important rival, is going to be able to shut off their taps, literally, and cut off their trade routes if their Navy can't force its way through those waters. And of course, this creates it's how powers think. And it creates a kind of terrible dynamic of relationships. The Indians have most of their capital ships deployed, and they have about 35 major warships deployed in those, which is the bulk of their fleet, are deployed in those waters, and they're building up their bases along the waterway there.
So it opens up another potential front for Indian-Chinese hostilities.
It's already happening.
Right.
It's already happening.
And if you, then to the extent you multiply the potential places of a flare-up, you'd have to say it's a kind of geometric progression, making conflict much more likely. It's not just twice as likely if you have two places where you're running button heads. It's geometrically more likely if you have two places.
It's geometrically more likely. Yeah. This is a piece from the Daily Telegraph. New Delhi reinforces its Indian Ocean fleet as tensions with China continue to rise. Now, the Chinese are also refitting a port in Pakistan to enable them to operate in those waters.
Well, that's going to make India feel really good.
That's not going to make India feel really good. And so you have a kind of tensions building there away from that northern frontier, which is the traditional spot you had those tensions. Now you have, because both of those powers are major economic exporting powers, they have military ambitions. They are both in the grip of ideological forces that make them much more sort of likely to not seek a confrontation, but not back down out of a confrontation.
Yep.
While this has been going on, Pakistan, which again, we don't cover as much as we should, although I know a fair amount about Pakistan because I had Pakistani friends in college and I've read a lot about it. Pakistan's alliance with Saudi Arabia, which goes back a long way, it's the Saudis who bankrolled the Pakistani nuclear project. They were the ones who put up the money on that to build what they called an Islamic bomb. That alliance has now come under strain. Why? because the Saudis' major oil market is?
It would have been the United States 10 years ago. It's not
now. But it's not. It's India.
Oh, okay.
It's in India. So the Saudis, who were always sort of pro-Pakistani because it was an Islamic country, they're now looking at India as a major market. And they also, you know, so they're looking, they're sort of, so there's been tensions between the Saudis and the Pakistanis over the Pakistanis have debt obligations to the Saudis and are having trouble meeting. The Saudis would usually let them write that down or sort of, you know, say, okay, you know, we'll figure out a new schedule. Now they're saying, you know, it, basically they're saying, you know, it, basically this is a from a piece from the, I believe this is from the Telegraph as well. And it says, yes, it's from the Telegraph. Oh, no, it's from the Financial Times. Pardon me. Saudi Arabia forces Pakistan to repay loan in diplomatic spat. That's what it's about. It's about.
It, Brendan, is the fact that the U.S. is not in the oil market for Saudi Arabia the way it was because we've become essentially independent, is that making Saudi Arabia more dependent on India and their other customers? And so that's one of the factors here.
Absolutely. And the U.S.'s ability to now basically provide its own fossil fuels and export fossil fuels is creating a fundamental power shift. And of course, it's one of the reasons why in our recent news, the opening of diplomatic relations between Israel and various the United Arab Emirates and
Bahrain,
pardon me, got tongue tied. Bahrain. Why? Because they have a common enemy. The Iranians and the Shia, who they see as, you know, in southern Iraq and in Syria, who they and Hezbollah, that who they see as being in Lebanon, who they see as being their common enemy. So that's why. And of course, Saudi Arabia's relationship with Israel, although the old king won't recognize Israel, the young guy who the crown prince there, who's made so much news often in a kind of negative way, he is much more interested in a closer relationship with them. With Israel for both technological development reasons and for military reasons, for because the Saudis are right now the leaders of the alliance against Iran, and they don't feel like they have the military experience or muscle to do it on their own.
Right.
So they no longer trust the U.S. because they know the U.S. doesn't need them anymore in terms of energy. That alliance went back to Franklin Roosevelt when he visited with the founder of the dynasty there in 44, I believe, on his way back from the Tehran conference. Is that right? I'm trying to think of the date, the Tehran conference. I believe it's 44. Off the top of my head, I'm not catching the date. I think it's a 44 conference. 44, or early 44. And is that right?
I can't. Scholars, listeners, you can consult your Google.
Consult your Google. But after the Tehran conference, on his way home from that, Roosevelt sort of established that alliance and basically said, we'll protect you because we're, you know, we want the Saudi oil. And of course, the U.S. still has a geostrategic interest in that Saudi oil, but it's not enough to, you know, to lead to the Saudis are nervous. And so are the other Emirate, you know, the Gulf countries are nervous, and they're nervous about Iran. We are going to come back. We're coming up on our second break right now. But I do want to say this is another piece from and it says this is from the Financial Times as well. Pakistan's actually, this is from Reuters. Pakistan's Prime Minister Khan plays down differences with ally Saudi Arabia. He's trying to talk it down off the ledge because he realizes, hey, where is this going?
But he realizes
he needs Saudi Arabia. He also needs China. And that's causing a kind of problem because the Saudis are unhappy about what's going on with those Uyghurs, even though they're quiet about it. Apparently, there's a lot of underneath the surface, hey, we're letting these Muslims be persecuted. We're the defenders of the holy place, and we're not speaking out about that, and that's a problem. You know, right. At least one faction in the royal family there feels that way.
Yeah.
So, you know, if you follow that, what's going on in Saudi Arabia. We're coming up on our second break. We're going to be right back. We're the Historians.
Hi, this is Mike DeStasio, host of Real Talk with the Hollywood Kid. Join me every Saturday from 2 to 3 when I'll be interviewing some of the biggest stars in showbiz right here on the legendary airwaves of AM 1550. And you can also stream us worldwide at WNTN1550AM.com. You can climb a
mountain. All right, we're back. We're the Historians. We're having a world history update. But before we get back to the contemporary world, Brendan, we're going to welcome back one of our earlier historical sponsors, Feudal Co-op. Brendan, you know, I've spent a fair amount of time in Great Britain over the last few years. And one thing I've noticed there are these markets called co-ops. Did you ever see any of those in Ireland?
I've seen them in both Britain and in Ireland, I think.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, of course, Britain has its big supermarkets too, like Tesco and Aldi, which are perfectly nice. It also has these sweet little co-ops where you can pick up everything from prepared foods like delicious Scotch eggs to staples like meat, fruit, and even real champagne at very reasonable prices. And there's a particularly nice co-op location in Granton-on-Spey. Well, our reliable historical sponsor, Feudal Co-op, has taken the co-op idea and combined it with the social and political program that I believe is poised to sweep through Northern Europe, across the Atlantic, and through North America. What is that idea? Well, Brendan, I'm sure you've noticed how disenchanted with capitalism a lot of people have become. And while socialism has its adherents in the media and blue state coffee houses, and Marxism reigns supreme on college campuses, these systems have one fatal weakness: history. I mean, none of these systems has proved workable for even a single century. And when implemented, they have almost always led to economic and/or cultural catastrophe. Well, the founders of Feudal Co-op are asking a very simple question. Isn't it time to look back to a socioeconomic system that survived for centuries, producing relatively stable, if somewhat malnourished, polities all over Europe? Yes, feudalism. Feudalism is the forgotten ism. And Feudal Co-op allows its members to re-embrace this underappreciated relic of the Middle Ages. Now, joining the co-op is simple. Members merely provide 3 days of physical labor per week on the co-op's extensive farms and occasional military service if the lands or the corporation's executive board are threatened with invasion or hostile social media, including nasty tweets. Beyond that, the co-op serfs, partners, have no formal requirements, and they are granted a warrant to shop in the nearly 400 co-op locations, where they will find medieval delicacies rarely encountered in a Whole Foods or Trader Joe's, including mutton, head cheese, gluten-free millet, as well as delicious spelt and farro, real mead and cider available by the cask, curdled milk, and my personal favorite, venison boar, which we were just talking about, and roast fowl.
Delicious.
Delicious. I mean, you'll forget that lame rotisserie chicken as soon as you sink your teeth into savory free-range grouse, pheasant, or quail. Sounds great, doesn't it? Now, for more information on Feudal Co-op or to offer your fealty, simply make humble request of your local liege lord or lady, or present yourself, preferably armed with mace, lance, axe, or dirk, at any Feudal Co-op location.
Feudal Co-op! Stock up the castle.
Stock it up. Stock it up, man. The forgotten ism. Time to give it a second shot. I think we're headed.
We may be headed that way. Yeah, I know.
Whether we want it or not.
Whether we want it or not, right?
Oh, it's good to be able to laugh.
Yeah.
Okay, so you had a couple more things I think you wanted to say about South Asia before we moved to East Asia.
East Asia, yeah. One thing is that, look, there's been shooting up on that contested border in the eastern part of Kashmir, as well as protest and suppression of Muslims within Kashmir who were protesting, and Indian and Pakistani artillery exchanging fire on their border in western Kashmir.
Well, what about the Indian and the Chinese militaries
beating each other up?
They've advanced to actually using weapons now? They're not just
There's been a few incidents that of shooting. I also want to point out something, actually two other things. There's some talk now about an alliance between India and Vietnam to create a counterweight to Pakistan. In other words, to create an ally on China's border in another region. Number three, some of these troops that were in those initial incidents I described in that earlier episode about the history of the Sino-Indian border disputes that went back to the War of 1962. But some of those troops that were up there that were killed in the recent incident where people were, some of those troops are of Tibetan origins, and the Indian Army has a Tibetan unit recruited from Tibetan refugees, and they're using them. And of course, this is part of the reason why the Chinese are incited. You know what I mean? Obviously, because China is so sensitive and so worried about Tibet, and even though they're in control of Tibet, they see this armed force of Tibetans on their border, they feel threatened.
Yeah, it's just a sign of how miseducated I am and Americans are that I can't even imagine a Tibetan armed forces. But of course, they have a tradition, a military tradition.
Right.
But of course, we think of them typically as sort of, you know, pacifist monks or whatever.
This is from Bloomberg News. Secret Tibetan military force raises stakes in India-China clash. You know, I mean, it's not just me. I noticed it, but then I saw the article, wow. You know, a full article on it. One other thing, and then I want to shift over to East Asia. There's so much we could say about this. I mean, again, it could be its own show or shows. Again, the demographic issue is in play. India's population continues to rise. It's going to surpass China if it hasn't already.
Wow.
China's population is stagnated and is falling in many parts of China.
Wow.
Again, that's part of what's going on a kind of deep level.
Brendan, I have the idea in my mind that when we were kids that India had a population of about 600 million and China was something like a billion. And I know China's, but if India has surpassed China in our lifetime, that is amazing.
They're about the same.
It's absolutely amazing.
China is losing population, you know, and there's just so much we could say, but that demographic pressure in India in terms of growth is fueling the Hindu, what they call Hindu nationalism, which I think is a false term in some respects. The BJP and the party there that's considered these other parties. But it is a very important issue, just as population decrease is a very important issue to the people in China. They're trying to break the habit of one or no children by party decree, but it's not working. No. This leads us into our East Asian, and I did want to talk about East Asia, because something has developed in Inner Mongolia that we need to talk about. Inner Mongolia has always been seen as a model area in terms of, okay, there's a lot of Han Chinese, Mandarin-speaking Chinese have been moved in, but they have generally had a decent relationship with the Mongolian-speaking people there. Suddenly, within the last few months, 6 months, the Chinese government has decided that they're going to force Mongolian school children to learn, you know, Mandarin as their first language, and they're trying to suppress other aspects of Mongolia. And of course, this is leading to protests and even rioting in Inner Mongolia. It is a major effort on the part of the Chinese government to assimilate or homogenize the Mongolian, just as they did with the Uyghurs and others. There's also some reports, which I don't know if they're accurate. Again, look, I don't want to seem, you know, again, of course, dealing with the reports about China, you don't know what you're getting from the mainstream media, whether what's accurate, what's not.
Yep.
There's some reports that the Chinese are forcing Mongolian men into these sort of, you know, forced factory labor situations that, you know, and moving them to different industrial areas and using them.
Yep.
I don't know.
I want to ask you a question about this. Is a part, of course, we understand that the communist Chinese government has an interest in the sinification, we might just call it, or homogenization under
right.
communist Chinese rule. But is there an ethnic element here that goes back to the fact pre-communist China that China has been ruled by a bunch of non-Han dynasties? That in fact, most of the rulers of China for the last, 600-700 years have not been Han Chinese. So they've been Manchurians, they've been Mongolians.
I've thought the same thing myself, and I think that that's a factor. But they don't, the news doesn't historicize it in that way, but I definitely think there is a factor there, that the part of this resurgence is a Han resurgence, and they're saying we're in control of these other groups, we'll make them conform to us.
And make sure this is never going to happen again.
And one of the things that's happened is, it's really fascinating you brought that up, is that one of the things that's gone on, which I actually have the piece right here from The Economist, that the Chinese Communist Party is using the title of the piece. It's from August the Economist, August 1st. The title: China digs its past. Officials claim an archaeological site proves that China has 5,000 years of continuous history, which is related to this stuff, in my opinion. The party wants control over its history, not only the character of that history, but the depth of it, to delegitimate these other regimes that control China at different points.
Right.
It becomes connected to this language policy thing.
Yeah, they do have 5,000 years of continuous history in China, but they don't have 5,000 years of a continuous regime.
Right.
That's ruled by Han Chinese.
No, that's exactly right. While that's been going on, there's been, of course, more pressure. Hong Kong, the one country, two systems thing has effectively completely collapsed. They've sent in a party hardliner to run security in Hong Kong.
Not a phrase you want to hear. If you're in Hong Kong. Party hardliner sent to handle security.
Right. There's been a lot of diplomatic tension between China and Australia, which is a major Chinese trading partner, particularly in the mining industry and natural resources. Mining is a huge industry, particularly in Northern Australia, a major source. But the Australian government, to their credit, they're hanging pretty tough. They feel like the Chinese have been trying to interfere in Australian affairs, and they don't want it, you know. So they're very they've taken, you know, even though it's a major trading partner, they've been pretty aggressive about holding their ground. There's also been more conflict in the South China Sea. There have been freedom of navigation maneuvers there by the United States fleet, by Australians. I think the French sent a warship through there. And of course, the Chinese, even though their claim was ruled illegitimate by the World Court, they are very militant about their position there. And of course, the South China Sea is the Balkans in terms of a great power conflict, just like the border of India, Pakistan, and China is another. They're like the Balkans in 1913. I mean, yeah. And then there's also been the issue of Taiwan. President Trump, who I think likes to get under the Chinese skin a little bit.
You think so?
Yeah, I think
I hadn't noticed that.
Yeah, I mean, he should follow my advice and start calling that portion of contested area of far eastern Russia where the Chinese border is, as I've recommended before, Greater Alaska or New Alaska, to join in all the conflicts. But that's just a joke, listeners. We shouldn't be doing that. There's been conflict in the South China Sea, but President Trump has sent several officials to Taiwan, which the government on the Communist Party hates that when American officials go there, and they've been screaming. We're also selling them,
pretending Taiwan is a real place,
right? Well, right. Part of it had to do with the public health response to COVID. While this has been going on, so this has led to threats against Taiwan and major sort of military not in a kind of an attack, but a kind of threatening way. More military maneuvers on the part of the
posturing
by Beijing near Taiwan. Exactly. While all this has been going on, I want to call people's having laid all that out. Two other things have been happening simultaneously. Those tensions in the far east of Russia are continuing. That guy who was poisoned. He's now in Germany. You know, they claim it's Putin who poisoned him. Maybe. But the Chinese, they're in the Chinese press. There's a kind of undercurrent of that used to be our land there. Mm-hmm. And that's continued.
Right.
I think some of the pressure against Inner Mongolia, which has always been a contested area between Outer and Inner Mongolia, have had contests. That may be related to that Chinese, that underlying pressure between the Russians and the Chinese. There's also been a purge within the Chinese Communist Party of their internal security forces. She is purging those forces, which I find pretty startling. One of the pieces I read from the Financial Times, it was a poor piece. The title of the piece was "The West Should Allow China to Continue to Sleep." Too late.
Right. Oh my
but God. One of the things this guy says is, which I find quite fascinating, is that as much as the West may resent the party itself, the party is the only lid on extreme Han nationalism, which has now re-erupted in China. Yeah, we don't think about it.
I'm sorry. That takes it a little too far for me. Like it's the Communist Party that's holding down the nationalist Han. It's possible. Okay, it's possible.
But
my goodness.
The piece was bad, but that point was interesting. He says that when I was in China, 10 years ago, I thought, wow, that there's this intense feeling of nationalism and the party has to ride that, and they have to adjust themselves to it. We're up on our final break. We're going to be right back. We're the historians.
This is Mike Jannetty. Join me every Wednesday afternoon from 12 noon to 2 p.m. for DJ Mike Jannetty's Disco Dance Party on WNTN.
Here's an interesting history about Demoulas Market Basket. The original store was opened in 1917 and located in an ethnically diverse neighborhood of Lowell, Massachusetts, called The Acre, which catered to Greek, Irish, and French immigrant communities in town. The store operated throughout the Great Depression, allowing its customers to purchase groceries on credit. Demoulas Market Basket, more for your dollar.
All right, we're back. We're the historians. For information on the Historians or any program on WNTN Global Echoes Radio, visit our website, WNTN1550AM.com, and you can reach us at TheRealHistorians@gmail.com. And if you want to see this show continue, sponsorships are available. Write us and let us know. Brendan, I said I was glad we were going to talk about the world because I was depressed at looking at the U.S., but I tell you, you have not helped.
Yes, I know.
I am even more depressed than I was before. There's so many hot spots out there. Goodness gracious.
These hot spots are related to a lot of things. It's not one thing. The demographic thing, very important. Resources, you know, energy supplies, very important.
Ethnic nationalism, religion.
Ethnic nationalism, religion, the way they're communicated using social media and mass media. Yes, extremely important. Extremely important. I did want to say one thing before we turned away from East Asia, which is that all this talk, which is in the American press, here's a piece from the Wall Street Journal. This is from June, but I have a whole bunch of them. It says, yes, America is in a Cold War with China. We can't be in a Cold War with China. We moved all our industry there. We should have thought if we wanted to have a Cold War with them, we should have kept the industry here. It's insane. The Chinese can't be in a Cold War with us. They're holding tons of American treasury. You know, they're the biggest holder. The Chinese and Japanese are the biggest holders of treasury bonds. You can't be in a war with someone you're entwined with like that. But you can go to war. You know what I mean? You can stumble into a war with that power. It's absolutely crazy because in the Cold War against the Soviet Union, we were basically separated systems. This, we're not separate. We're part of the same underlying economic and technological system.
It's an excellent point, but you'd have to say that one positive thing that's come out of this pandemic has been, I hope, the realization that we're too entwined with a lot of places, but certainly with China, and that we have to be able to make our own medicines and build some of our own stuff and create our own medical gear that we have to be able to do that here. That's a national security issue, right?
It's not only a national security issue. People talk about it that way, but I will say this, because of the tone of universities, you know, with all the left, you know, sort of rhetoric of universities, it picks up this Marxist thing like labor is alienating. The factory is a site of whatever. Factories make communities. Labor, where you work hard and try to perfect something, gives meaning to lives.
They also make stuff. So there's
you make real things. I completely agree. And even if we were going to offshore things, would it not be make more sense to offshore to Mexico and make Mexico a wealthier and more stable country? Of course, that would help everyone in Mexico.
It's a
country we border on. And of course, that's not anti-Chinese to me. I don't blame the Chinese for wanting all the industry to come there. No. They want to make China strong. It's a perfectly legitimate thing to do. I feel like our national discourse about these issues is horrible. It is horrible.
To the extent that it exists.
Exists at all. Yeah. It is terrible. It's just there's a lack of rational conversation, and it goes to the very highest reaches of government and business.
Yep. They should all be listening to the Historians.
Yes, at all the time. all right. Now, it is time for our continuing feature, This Week in Historical News.
This Week in Historical News. Boy, I hope it's cheerier than the news is.
Well, we're going to start with a bunch of obituaries, so I don't know how cheery it's going to be.
You love the obituaries. I don't get it with this.
I do. Of course, Ruth Bader Ginsburg passed away, Supreme Court Justice. I have spoken harshly of her in previous episodes. But I'm not going to do that in this episode. I will come back to that because I think – but I want to say – I will say this about Ruth Bader Ginsburg. Even her political and legal opponents spoke extremely highly of her personal character and her personal deportment and her personal integrity. Whatever you think of her, when one of your closest friends is Scalia and he's your ideological opposite, it says something good about you as a person.
I agree.
That it's not all about, you identify in a certain way as what you're looking for in people. And that you respect integrity of others, even though their views are different than you.
You can be friends with people who hold different views about you. Great. Different views than you do. Absolutely. I agree.
And she had that. And people rightly praise that as being someone who's like that. I will not speak ill of her in that regard. Jürgen Schadeberg has died. Who is he? He is a photographer. I believe he's a German. He was born in Germany, but lived in South Africa, and almost all the famous photos that we have of Nelson Mandela at Robben Island when he's imprisoned, they come from this guy.
Huh.
Yeah, and a number of other, almost all the famous photography we have from Africa comes from him. It's all really right. South Africa, in terms of all the apartheid era.
I like the sound of you crunching up your newspaper now.
Yeah, this is a good sound effect.
It's a real thing, listeners. It's not being added in post-production.
Yes. It's the actual experience
actual
of crumpling.
Sound effect. Yep.
Brent Scowcroft, I don't believe I mentioned that. He died in the summer. He died. Of course, he was at the core of foreign policy in America for 30 or 40 years and was a pretty restrained guy. They took a moderate middle ground position on a lot of things. He also helped build the famous first Gulf War coalition that completely crushed Saddam, the Republican Guard, and kicked him out of Kuwait.
I want to say he held positions in both Republican and Democrat administrations.
Yeah. Another person like Ruth Bader Ginsburg, who didn't necessarily define himself, just saying that he had some idea of service to country and that he could be friendly with people of different ideological positions and political positions. Yeah. Going back to our East Asia, Lee Teng-hu, who's a former president of Taiwan, has died. He was the person who transformed Lee Teng-hu. He may not be remembered by most people, but he was the person after, of course, Chiang Kai-shek was in China, that he was the person who turned Taiwan into an actual democracy. In other words, when it was really before a one-party state and he introduced more democratic representative rule of law practices into Taiwanese society. He's passed away. Juan Mars, who was a famous writer about the Spanish Civil War and its aftermath, most people won't have heard of him, but they did have carry a very substantial obituary of him, thank goodness, in the Sunday Boston Globe. He was a really, really sort of a strong chronicler of the experience of the defeat of the Republic, what happens to people from both sides after the war, both in Spain and as refugees. A really interesting figure. The one I definitely want to get in, though, then we're going to go to some other more enjoyable type of things, is John Hume, the leader of the Social Democratic Labor Party, winner of the Nobel Peace Prize, the person probably single most responsible in many respects for the Good Friday Agreement that brought the end to the fighting in Northern Ireland. He's passed away. He was a very good man, I thought. I mean, he risked a lot. He was the one who said, look, we're not going to get anywhere until we talk to the provost. We got to talk to Martin McGuinness and Gerry Adams. We got to get them in the system. And then we got to talk to the British government, too. In other words, he was a Northern Irish politician. He was from Derry. I believe Derry. I think that's right. I'd have to check that. He believed the difference between him and the provost was he wanted a united Ireland, but he wanted peace more, and he didn't believe in violence. So he had a legitimacy with, sort of middle class people and people abroad. He had no blood on his hands.
Yeah.
And Martin McGuinness, who becomes really central to this whole process, who I'm going to talk about in a future episode. Martin McGuinness would have said, unlike Gerry Adams, who's always been kind of coy about it. Yeah, I got blood on my hands. I was involved. That's the way it is. We were being repressed. There was no other way. We had a fight. And he said, my role was I got people to, I said no more civilian targets. That was my role as leader. I appointed us towards British military and police targets, but he said, I have blood on my hands. I'm not going to, John Hume didn't have blood on his hands, and that allowed him to talk to everyone. He also had a lot of support in America, and as much as we may kid about and sort of go after Bill Clinton, Clinton worked with him, and that's how a lot of ways the good, not Clinton himself, but his representatives, they worked with him. George Mitchell, the guy from Maine, I believe he's from Maine, George Mitchell.
Yeah, he is.
Yeah, he worked with them, and they got it done. He's passed away, and it was treated as a real national loss in Ireland, and I think, rightly so, to everyone, to both British and American, Irish people. He really did champion Ireland, and he was a good person who tried to build a peaceful coalition going forward. Okay. Africa is free of polio after a decades-long campaign. Africa is free of polio.
Piece of good news.
A piece of good news. The last wild polio cases, which were in Nigeria, in the northern part of Nigeria, in that area I was talking about, the demographic area where they have population explosion in northern Nigeria, Islamic groups are active there, including militant groups. They've gotten everyone immunized. There are no new cases of polio. It's been eradicated. The only place it's left is on the Pakistani-Afghanistan border. As you know, and I think probably other people who know me know, my father's sister had polio. She was terribly you know, impacted by it in her life. I knew her very well, was a very good person. Polio, to me, I see that as being a real, and all credit to the Nigerian, you know, public health people who just stayed with it, even in very dangerous and difficult conditions. So that has gone forward. I am concerned. There's several things I had here. Maybe since we're coming up, are we on time yet? No.
4 minutes.
There are some good things, but there's been a lot of bad things too. They've done a new survey, and 2/3 of millennials and people in Generation Z don't know that 6 million Jewish people were killed in the Holocaust.
Good.
It is totally unacceptable. It is not acceptable.
You know what, Brendan? It doesn't surprise me though.
I know, but it's Jay. It's not acceptable. They have to know that history. And I mean, look, I know exactly what you're saying, but
our school systems are way more interested in teaching them about what happened 6 months ago, more interested in that than they are in talking about even the Second World War, which you and I consider basically contemporary history.
Right. And that they not know that. They don't know what happened.
Yeah.
How can they, you know, come to any kind of understanding of anything that's going on, you know, not
the answer. You answer your own question. They can't.
I know. All right. I did want to mention I did think of this as a good outcome to a bad story. I think I talked about this in an early episode where Rio Tinto, which is a huge mining concern in Australia, had destroyed those two Aboriginal sites.
Yep.
At first they tried to get away with this. Listen to this. It shows you how perverse in a sense the world is, but also that there is a little justice. The first tried to say, well, okay, we'll punish people. And I quote, Rio cuts bonuses over destroyed banks. But in the end, the CEO of Rio Tinto was kicked out of his job for having done, you know, I guess they knew.
For having destroyed these historical sites.
Archaeological sites. He got kicked out of his job, which I have to say, I approve. Yep. 2 minutes. There are a bunch of other things to go, you know, we could go to. I think that, you know, it really is a kind of, you know, I don't want to close on this because it's so difficult. We are living in a difficult time. Peace from the, this is from the, I believe, BBC News site or Reuters. Did fish sauce in Vietnam come from ancient Rome via the Silk Road? They're claiming that the Vietnamese are stealing the Romans, have stolen the Romans, ancient Romans, fish sauce recipe. Thousands of years ago and are using it.
Well, it's called garum, that Roman fish sauce. It's probably one of the nastiest smelling things ever invented by man, but I think it kept basically forever.
Apparently, there's evidence of Roman, you know.
It was like styrofoam or Hostess Twinkies.
Right.
It keeps forever.
There's another piece here. It says, it's from the Financial Times from September 7th. Can lithium power Cornwall in England's revival? And if you read this thing, basically what they're saying is, well, there'll be this island off the coast of Europe that has a rare metal, and other people will sail around to get the rare metal. In other words, they're restoring Cornwall's role in the tin trade from
exactly
years
the,
ago.
The Bronze Age. Is Cornwall actually producing lithium?
They're going to be able to produce this, yes. Now, we have to conclude. They're going to close. I can't get to Robin Lane Fox. But I do want to point this out. There's two things here, and then we're going to close. There's an article in The Economist about the Habsburg dynasty, and the title of the article is A Breed Apart. If you're following us about the Habsburgs' tendency to marry their cousins, you'll understand that title.
Right, Habsburg jaw.
Right, the Habsburg jaw. The second piece here, which is from the number of Yahoo News, a number of outlets, the grandson of U.S. President Warren G. Harding and his lover, Nan Britton, went to court in an effort to get the Republican president's remains exhumed for the presidential memorial. Why? Now, I don't know this person. His name is James Blasing. I don't know who he is. He says he told an Ohio court that he is seeking Harding's disinterment as a way to establish with scientific certainty that he is the 29th president's blood relation. James, having read about Harding, I'm saying leave that thing in a tomb. We are coming up on the end of our time. We'll be back soon. We're the historians. Thank you.
Thank you.